Good morning, everybody. I'd like to call this meeting of the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee to order. We have a quorum present on this Thursday, March 7th. All of our hearings are recorded and live streamed on House Public Information. So we have minutes from March 4th, and there is actually a correction. Representative Petersburg, do you want to review the minutes and let the committee know the change that needs to be made?
Yeah, thank you. This is something that I wouldn't have caught, so I appreciate either Matt Burris or whoever caught this. But about halfway down, right about in the middle, House File 4237, Liz Lagarde, from forecasts that were provided, somehow got added or kept from something else. That should be eliminated because that's not part of the bill. Otherwise, the rest of it is all okay. So with that correction, I would move the approval of the minutes.
Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. So we have four bills on the agenda, and the first bill is House File 4268, and that is authored by Representative Senator Mura. Unfortunately, she is ill, and so I will actually be presenting this bill in her stead, and I will move the gavel over to Vice Chair Tabkin.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Chair Hornstein. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, so House File 4268, I'm moving to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future bill.
Perfect, and if you want to begin with opening comments.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members, you'll recall last year in the transportation bill, we made major investments in bus rapid transit. And one of the reasons I'm so excited about BRT, both on highways and arterial streets, is that this is one of those transit issues that has attracted a lot of support and ridership and even some bipartisan agreement on this particular mode. And so it's very exciting as we move forward on transit. One of the aspects of BRT is forming a significant network of arterial BRTs. We have the A, B, C, D, E, and F lines in various stages of implementation and operation. And this is going to bring better service to communities. And as we expand the system, it results in shorter transit times. It serves many of the more transit-reliant communities and developed areas of the region. And as I said, increases ridership. Even during COVID, the height of the COVID pandemic, while there were decreases in all modes of transit, including BRT, some of the decreases were not as pronounced. So people clearly using this system. And so we want to make sure that as the system is built out, that every rider can be accommodated and access this new and exciting transit option. And so we are in this bill making various ADA improvements at stations and in near stations. And I know that Representative Senator Mura has been working with local governments on this legislation, but there have been some concerns raised that I've been made aware of. The Met Council has reviewed the legislation, and I think we're going to be working more closely with them to get this right, because the Met Council is also very committed to this, the success of bus rapid transit. And we have some of their key staff with us. They're not going to be testifying, but I wanted to acknowledge them, especially Katie Roth, who's been sort of an incredible visionary in terms of building out the system. So with that, members, I think there are a couple of testifiers that are going to speak in support of this, but I do want to reassure members of the committee and others who may be seeing this bill for the first time that we are going to be making some changes as this moves through. So when we say laid over, it will be laid over, and we'll accommodate some of the concerns that have been raised. So.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And so we have some testifiers here. And so the first presenters we have is on the list is Lisa Cerny and Nick Peterson. Are we? Is that happening together?
Chair Hornstein, committee members, it's happening separate. I have
okay.
one presentation and then Nick Peterson will follow.
Perfect. Thank you very much. You may proceed. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. I am Lisa Cerny. I am the Assistant County Administrator for County.
Could you make sure to grab the mic? There you go.
Is that better?
Yep.
I'll do that again. My name is Lisa Cerny. I'm the Assistant County Administrator in the Public Works line of business for Hennepin County. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. Hennepin County is a champion for improving our regional transit system to better serve Minnesotans with convenient, equitable access to jobs, schools, and their daily needs. Together, we need to take these steps to provide a more equitable transportation system to meet our climate action goals, to help reduce greenhouse gas emissions and vehicle miles traveled. I may say VMT if I get into a bad habit. To help meet these goals, a more collaborative approach is needed in building arterial BRT transit projects. The current scope of Metro Transit's arterial BRT network is focused on station area and generally includes pedestrian accommodations in two of the four intersections. The photo you see is the upper right, lower left. ADA accessible accommodations have been added. Top left, bottom right, they were left out. This does not ensure access for all people to this transit service. Additional accessibility improvements are needed at stations to better serve all transit users. This is a photo of the same intersection from a different perspective and shows the ADA upgrades on the right-hand side of the photo. Made next to the station quadrant. This is at the intersection of Chicago Avenue and 42nd in South Minneapolis with the D-Line project. A high-quality transit system, ADA upgrades are also needed on the opposite corners to provide access, again, for all users. Hennepin County and other local governments work to align our capital projects with our arterial BRT projects to fund safety and multimodal improvements in these corridors to ensure successful projects. A recent example under construction now is the B line along Lake Street in South Minneapolis. This is a vibrant, diverse corridor that serves as the main east-west artery for thousands of residents every day. And it is a corridor with above crash rates at many busy intersections. The image shows the current configuration of Lake Street for this project. Our goal is to transform this into a corridor where all users feel safe and where businesses can thrive. The county and city invested tens of millions, and we secured a $12 million federal raise grant to significantly improve the corridor. This project includes accessibility upgrades, traffic signal revisions, lane adjustments, and pavement resurfacing. We analyzed how to improve access and transit reliability. the project includes converting some travel lanes to dedicated transit lanes. With these modifications, we believe the average transit trip will be 20% faster, and the roadway will be safer for people walking and driving. These are the types of specific transit improvements that should be included initially when projects are scoped. With the introduction of dedicated transit lanes, the other lanes need to be modified, requiring changes to signals and signal poles. This cross-section shows the before on the top and the after configuration with the roadway striping and signal modifications with the dedicated transit lanes on the bottom. Again, these improvements should be included in arterial BRT project scope and cost. The region needs strong leadership to ensure BRT projects are done right and best serve residents with quality transit. We have been close partners in that effort with the help of significant state and federal funding, but that is not guaranteed or likely for every corridor. Other local governments share our concern. Ramsey County, Anoka County, City of Minneapolis, City of St. Paul, City of Fridley collectively believe that Metro Transit needs to include station, ADA, accessibility, and transit-specific infrastructure in the initial arterial BRT scope. We ask for your support with this bill. We thank you for your time, and we also appreciate that there are continuing conversations that will be occurring.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Next up, we have Nick Peterson. Introduce yourself and proceed when you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Nick Peterson, the city engineer for the City of St. Paul, and I'm here to offer a local government perspective of a municipal flavor. So I speak in support of the spirit of 4268 today in an effort to minimize the capital burden of these projects and make them more comprehensive, a more comprehensive win for the public. While this item offers many potential benefits and challenges to the local communities, I will focus on accessibility. I don't offer these comments in opposition to the great work that Metro Transit does. Quite the contrary, the work of Metro Transit is invaluable to St. Paul and to other local government units in the region to provide a connected and accessible transportation network for everyone. It is therefore exciting that Bus Rapid Transit or BRT corridors are growing in numbers and extent. It is also concerning that overall accessibility needs of BRT corridors cannot always be met because of the burden of local government. Every intersection has four corners. Pedestrians boarding or alighting a bus need to walk to and from their destination, sometimes crossing many intersections, requiring a series of different corner crossings and touching a different corner to get to a station. That means that all four pedestrian corners within an intersection are important, not just those adjacent to the bus station. All crossings should be made accessible and safer for pedestrians to arrive in all directions, including pedestrian ramps, but also safety elements to make it safer for folks to get there, including extensions of curb lines to narrow crossings and to make it safer for pedestrians. Funding is an important aspect here. While this end goal may seem very obvious, current resource limitations exist for local government. Metro Transit will provide compliant ADA pedestrian ramps immediately adjacent to their stop areas, but not for other corners of the same intersection. The other corners bring additional costs to local government, who is expected to participate in costs for some or all of the costs on those corners, but more importantly, expected to completely fund ADA improvements on all corners that don't have a station. So adjacent to stations, those required improvements are covered. Why does this matter? In St. Paul alone, we already spend a significant chunk, almost two-thirds in 2026, I was looking through our preparation for our next five-year plan. of our municipal state aid. It's almost two-thirds of our municipal state aid, which is largely gas tax, as our local share for projects is spent on projects led by other jurisdictions. Every time we line up our next five-year plan, more needs arise from other jurisdictions, which are valuable, but they bring a burden. BRT projects are one of these additions to local government five-year plans. I know from my experience in working with other cities on the other side of the river that some cities spend their entire annual municipal state aid funding on projects that are within other jurisdictions or led by other jurisdictions. That would include large road reconstruction projects or Metro Transit BRT corridors. Local government is frequently relied upon to make projects work for the community at the detriment of other local needs as a result. So my ask today is your support for 4268 to minimize the capital burden of projects and to make them a more comprehensive win for the public. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and thank you to Representative Senator Mira for this bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. Next up, we have Steve Huser.
You have a question?
Okay. Mr. Huser, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Steve Huser. I'm a government relations representative with the city of Minneapolis. Much of what I was likely going to say has been touched on, so I'll save the committee time. I want to start by thanking the chair for hearing this bill and presenting it on behalf of Representative Senator Mira, who's been a good champion on this bill. The city of Minneapolis fully supports this bill. We do think it's going to lead to, you know, more complete projects and make the projects that we are investing in more accessible to all of our communities. So I'll just leave it at that, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. That is the end of the folks we have signed up to testify. Anybody from the audience who would like to testify on this bill? All right, seeing none, we'll move on to member discussion. And first on the list is Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to thank Representative Senator Mira for bringing this forward. I've had quite a frustration with my county when it comes to getting the active transportation dollars that we allocated last year to those counties to actually spend the money on active transportation in areas where there's people. I'm hoping that this might be a solution to it, but if the counties aren't going to spend that active transportation money, maybe this could be the funding source for that project. So just wanted to thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Hornsey, would you like to respond to these?
No, thank you, Chair Cagle. I do think that this is a shared responsibility with the local units of government and the Met Council, and I think that's where we'll try to, and of course the state is a partner, but I think that's where we'll try to do some fixing of the bill. And yes, we have an active transportation account, and this is important. And I think what's being raised here is that, you know, the accessibility isn't just at the bus stop. And so, whose responsibility is it ultimately to make sure that, you know, we have accessibility at you know, across the street from the bus stop, for example. And so that's where we're going to have to, do some more discussion. But, yeah, shared responsibility, I think.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This question is for Mr. Peterson, if he can come back up. Thank you. So, Mr. Peterson, my question is, as you're building your own, like, so the city is responsible for the roads, the city is responsible for other sidewalks, other areas. When you are building or upgrading those roads and sidewalks that you determine that you don't, that the Met Council has no responsibility for, are you constructing them in a way that is not ADA compliant currently?
Mr. Peterson.
So, Mr. Chair, member, when construction projects are built, they are built to current ADA standards. On a construction project that we have planned and that we lead, the city of St. Paul follows ADA requirements consistent with what's current.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. So what you're saying is that any of these, potentially that picture that we saw, one can assume that those sidewalks were created prior to 1990 when the ADA compliant law was passed. So this is, we're potentially looking at a sidewalk that's 33, 34 years old.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, member, I'm unable to speculate on the details for another jurisdiction's infrastructure.
Do you have in your jurisdiction an area in which there are non-ADA compliant sidewalks that are over 33 years old or under 33 years old?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chair, member, the answer is yes.
Perfect.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So question, the issue with this is that every other city outside of the state of Minnesota, in the state of Minnesota, outside of the Met Council, they're responsible for their sidewalks, they're responsible for their roads. What we're doing here is a wonderful gift to cities within the Met Council. It's a wonderful gift to them. So I can understand why the city of St. Paul would come here and testify. I can understand why the county, why Hennepin County would be here and say, yes, this is great, because they're looking at their budget and they're saying, this is some way that we can offset our costs and make someone else do our work for us. Every other city outside of this jurisdiction is responsible for their own sidewalks, ensuring that their own sidewalks are ADA compliant. I don't walk over, you know, I don't go to Hennepin County and walk around on the sidewalks a lot. This is a local entity. People who are walking generally are fairly locally condensed. Otherwise, they're getting into their vehicles and they're driving around, or they're getting into buses and they're getting off at the bus stop. Now, I understand the argument that the other side of the road should be ADA compliant, but I think that cities are getting a heck of a deal having the Met Council pay for two of the four corners. It's a heck of a deal.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Rep. Hornstein, I'm just curious, this is kind of a 30,000-foot question, but, you know, the county and cities are elected by voters. Why aren't we allowing the counties and cities to make this decision all by themselves? They represent the voters. The voters have an interest. Why do we even have the Met Council as part of this decision? That's just trying to get a better clarification. Thanks.
Representative Murphy, if you could clarify your question a little bit, like what is this decision that you're talking about?
Just the whole idea of dollars being spent, and Rep. Hornstein commented that we're sharing this. And my question is why don't they have full responsibility, since they're represented by the voter and the Met Council is not?
Chair Hornstein, if you'd like more clarification on that question, because I don't totally understand it, so.
Well, first of all, I think the Met Council should be elected, but that's spent a lot of time on that this past fall. But look, you know, we have, this is infrastructure that is new. It's important, and you know, we're looking at city streets here, and city and county streets, and so. You know, if that's why I think it's a shared responsibility, and I think the scope of this bill, I think, has to be looked at, and I think that there's just some language that needs to be clarified and cleaned up, and yeah, because people are accessing this new mode of transit from more than just the stop, I think there's, you know, some reason for there to be shared responsibility. Now, is it to the extent, you know, we're talking about intersections and things of that nature, it may not be, you know, in close proximity of the station. You know, then I think we have to take, you know, a second look at that. But the ultimate goal here is to make sure that anyone who wants to access this mode of transportation should be able to access it. So, you know, I think you raise a valid point, and that's why we're going to take a second look at some of the scope of this legislation.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Thank you, Representative Hornstein.
So I have a couple of just comments about this, and then we'll go to Lee Petersburg. And then Chair Hornstein to finish this up. But so this, as I've communicated with Representative Sensenmuir and other folks, is I have similar Representative Olson, I have very large concerns about this bill and this path moving forward for a couple different reasons. One, I also agree that it's very much ADA accessibility, and sidewalk accessibility is a local jurisdiction issue. As these projects come through, I also agree with Chair Hornstein that there should be some level of shared participation on this, because it's an unexpected thing that's not necessarily in a CIP that is an unexpected. So there needs to be some sort of shared burden on paying for this, but also it needs to be, and I've talked to Representative Sensenmayer about this, is it needs to be very much tightened up as to exactly what this includes and exactly where it needs to go, because this the sales tax that we passed last year, in my opinion, has to be used and prioritized 100% for building out our transit system, so that we have a transit system that works for everyone in all parts of the region and everywhere. And if we are continuously pulling money out of this, specifically out of the sales tax, to pay for ADA accessibility, to pay for other things, which we've already pulled a fair amount from the sales tax as it is, and I want to make sure that all of this money that is humanly possible goes to building out our transit system. And we have to make sure that we have a transit system that is accessible to everyone that is moving forward. We've got a lot of work to do on that. And so I'm really happy that folks are working together to tighten this up and to move this forward and to get something that makes sense for all parties involved. So Lee Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to get back to two basic questions that I have. The presentation that we had with the PowerPoint, the second to the last PowerPoint, had a reorganization, redesign of a corridor in which it goes from two lanes of traffic going both ways to only one lane of traffic going both ways. It indicates that the bus lane is only going one directional. So from that, can I assume then that return to that particular location would have to occur on a different street and different direction? Is that this?
Is this a question for Ms. Cerny?
Probably.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to suggest Ms. Cerny.
Was that your full question, Lee Petersburg?
For this, and then I've got one more.
Perfect. Ms. Cerny.
Chair members, on the Lake Street corridor, the traffic engineers, yes. Yep. The traffic engineers, would you like me to put it back on?
No, that's fine.
It's all right.
Chair members, the analysis that was done on Lake Street was to ensure that the entire corridor functioned. And so in some segments of the corridor, we identified the capacity and ability to put transit only lanes. And in other parts of the corridor, we prioritized other safety actions like a turn lane or a bump out. And so, yes, in some cases, the buses in either direction will be in a shared lane. And in some cases, they will be in a transit only lane. Again, a lot of analysis went into this in order to make sure that we could accelerate the transit rider experience so that we could increase the ridership on transit.
Lee Petersburg.
Okay, thank you. So just you nod your head, but what I understand then is that the return could be on a regular traffic lane, but the other direction it would be identified for bus only.
Ms. Cerny.
Okay. All right, thank you. And my second question is that this bill really deals with bus rapid transit and not all transit and not all buses. Now, with it, so that's specific. And I noticed the Met Council didn't come to testify, but do we know in the expansion and development of bus rapid transit projects, how much of this is currently being done and how much of this is going to be new for them? Do we have any idea what that
would
might
you
be?
Like someone from Met Council to come and answer that question?
If they're willing to answer that question, that'd be great.
Yep, I think we have folks in the room that can help with that. Thank you for being here. Please state your name for the record and proceed. And did you hear the question okay?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Katie Roth, Director, Arterial BRT at Metro Transit. Would you please restate the question?
Lee Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. So this legislation is about bus rapid transit, and I know further ongoing construction projects are going forward with this. How much of this bill is already being done, and how much of it is going to be new in which you're going to have to develop new policies and cost factors, et cetera.
Ms. Grau.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, with regards to what is happening right now, I will concur with the previous testifiers that Metro Transit projects of arterial BRT program take on the pedestrian ramps immediately adjacent to the stations at an intersection. And with the graphic that was shown of Chicago and 42nd, you could see that the opposite two corners were not included with the project. That is consistent with how we have scoped these projects to date. Going forward, were that to change, there would be additional cost that would need to be added to the projects.
Lee Petersburg.
Okay, thank you. That's helpful. Do we have any idea if there's a, if you anticipate kind of a percentage of an increase for that? Because it's important as we put together financing appropriations that we do that accordingly as well.
Ms. Grau.
Mr. Chair and members, we received a request for a fiscal note earlier this week and are working to complete that right now. So that is in progress and we'll be able to come back to the committee with that.
Lee Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I know because it's being laid over, a lot of these things are going to be detailed. That's just something that I have concern with because we have to, we got to balance the budget. We can't just create more funding. So thank you for that.
Thank you. Any final comments, Chair Hornstein?
No, I appreciate the really good committee discussion. This is why we hear bills like this, flushing out some of the issues, getting the perspective of the committee, both sides of the aisle. And, you know, I'm looking forward to working with Representative Sensenmira as this bill progresses or is held over. And hopefully, you know, all of the stakeholders can come up with a solution that works for everybody, but most importantly works for the transit ridership.
Thank you very much, Chair Hornstein. And with that, 42, Chair Hornstein renews his motion that House File 4268 be laid over for future consideration. And with that, House File 4268 is laid over.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. And I think you're up next.
I am. House File 4104.
All right. Our next bill is House File 4104. And to your bill and motion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 4104 be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Excellent. So we have a motion. And I understand you have an amendment as well?
Yeah, we have a quick A1 amendment which changed the effective date per the fiscal note and a request of DVS from to October 1st of 2024 for implementation.
Okay, so we'll move the amendment. Is there discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. To your bill, Vice Chair Tapke.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. House File 4104 came to me from the Auto Dealers Association. I have Scott Lambert here to testify on the bill. But what is going on here is there's been a reinterpretation, closer reading of statute that is causing some issues with leases in with auto dealers. And so with this new reading of how statute works, there's lack of data sharing that needs to happen between when a lease is ended and someone wants to lease a new vehicle. And so with that, this lack of data sharing will delay. So if you want to get a new lease on a new vehicle, it will delay that transaction days or weeks in order to get that done. And so this language will amend that and make sure that all that data can be shared. So that's why we head to Judiciary next. A couple things with this is there is a fiscal note of $30,000 that will be absorbed by DVS through there. And so that came through yesterday. And also the change of the effective date was on there as well. And I just also want to thank Lee Petersburg for his support on this bill also. So Chair Hornstein, if we go to Mr. Lambert.
Okay.
Mr. Lambert, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Scott Lambert. I'm president of the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association. As Representative Tabke said, we are not seeking a major change here. We're really just seeking the status quo and the ability to continue to serve our customers as efficiently as possible. It's all about the customers. Mr. Chairman, when a person turns in a leased vehicle at the end of the lease, the dealers tap into the state system, and they need to do two things to ensure a proper transaction. First, they look at the owner of the vehicle, and the owner of the vehicle is going to be a bank or a credit union or a captive finance agency, something like that, some kind of financial institution. And then they look at the identity of the lessee to determine if the person sitting in front of them is actually connected to the vehicle, unlike a sale of a vehicle or a trade-in where we can look at the title and the driver's license. We don't have that ability for a leased vehicle. And we've been doing it this way for a very, very, very long time. Unfortunately, the data privacy laws have sort of grown up around this practice, and Driver and Vehicle Services took a fresh look at the governing statute and determined that dealers really don't necessarily have permission to access information about the lessee. We can access information about the owner, but not the lessee. Without this authority, the dealers would not be able to verify that the person sitting in front of them is in fact the lessee, and we'd need to go back to the financial institution that owns the vehicle for that information. So instead of a transaction that could take minutes, it could take days or even weeks to get that information. As a result, the customer will be left in limbo and unable to conclude the transaction. It'll be difficult for them to lease or purchase a new vehicle while the vehicle they think they've turned in is still technically in their name. So the bill simply adds the licensed dealer to the list of exemptions that can view this information. It's limited only to those circumstances when a dealer is involved in a sale or a lease transaction. We have vetted this out with Driver and Vehicle Services over the past few months, and I understand that they have no objections to this bill, and we hope to be able to move forward with it. Mr. Chairman, those are my remarks. I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Lambert. Any questions from committee members? Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to testify either for or against House File 4104? Committee questions. All right. Vice Chair Tabke, any closing comments?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. This is, as Mr. Lambert noted, this is already something that is in process right now. We're just making sure that everyone is able to continue it. So I appreciate everyone's support.
Okay. The motion before us is that House File 4104 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All of those opposed, the motion prevails. You're on your way to Judiciary.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Tabke.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. Members, now we are on our third bill of the day, House File 3374. And I will move that House File 3374 be placed in front of the committee and laid over. And Representative Keel, I understand you have an amendment.
Yes.
And we have the majority leader of the Senate for many years with us.
And my constituent.
Okay.
So yeah. we come from God's country, correct? Anyway, thank you very much for the committee. It's good to be back in transportation. It's been a while since I've been here. We have a industry, you've probably all heard about it, the sugar industry on the west side of Minnesota entirely. Actually, we could go all the way down to Renville, but in our case, we're talking about American Crystal and being able to haul sugar beets across the river into the East Grand Forks plant. So this is a real specific request. And former Senator Rudd, I can't call him anything but Senator Moe, anyway, is going to explain exactly the detail of what we need to have happen. So,
thank you, Chair Hornstein, members of the Transportation Committee. My name is Roger Moe, and I do government relations work for American Crystal Sugar here in Minnesota. Crystal Sugar is the largest producer of sugar in the United States, and they operate on both sides of the border. Farmers are on both North Dakota and Minnesota side, and they operate five processing plants. And this particular legislation is focused on one of those plants, the East Grand Forks processing plant. The harvest, the way it works, is starting in late summer. The farmers pull the beets and truck them to 111 different piling stations up and down the valley. And then as it gets colder, and that's been a problem this year because the beet industry depends upon keeping the beets frozen and cold, and that didn't happen this winter. But usually that's the case. And then as the weather gets colder, they begin a full processing of the pulling of the beets and processing of the sugar beets in the plants. Good weather, they can do it in about 2 weeks. Bad weather might take a couple of months. And what this particular proposal is proposing to do is to allow a truck trailer operation that is now used in North Dakota to be able to haul from five different piling stations in North Dakota that process their beets in East Grand Forks, Minnesota. And so we're asking for special legislation that would allow this truck trailer operation. It's 122,000 pounds, and so thus it would take special legislation to be able to travel approximately 2.5 miles from the North Dakota border, about a mile, a little over a mile on U.S. Highway 2, and then south on a city street in East Grand Forks for about a mile, and then around the corner to the processing plant. And why it's significant is that it will reduce the truck traffic on those streets by 30%. And believe it or not, that's over 4,000 trips. That's how many truck hauls are in and out of that plant during the processing season. It will reduce fuel use. It will truck and trailer operation has 11 axles, so it spreads out the weight. More rubber on the road for safety. So that's pretty much it, Mr. Chairman. There are resolutions that were passed both by the city council unanimously and the county board, Polk County Board, and the county engineer, Mr. Sanders. He's also supports this as well. Thank you.
Representative Petersburg, you have a question.
Just this, Mr. Chair. Unless I missed it, I don't think we have actually moved the DE-1 to get it in front of us the way it is, so I will move that DE-1 amendment as well and have it in front of us, and we can have further discussion. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Could you explain the DE-1?
DE-1 is the change that happened in the Senate, correct? And maybe you, Senator Moe, should say something.
Chair Hornstein, members of the committee, the amendment is from the Minnesota Department of Transportation to conform with how they would like the law written. So,
all right. Discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, the motion prevails. Okay. Any other? We have one more testifier, and Elise, who signed up ahead of time, if there's anyone else, you should hear from them as well. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Makarios. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. My name is Kyle Makarios, and I represent the Teamsters Joint Council 32. The Teamsters are opposed to this House file. Teamsters Joint Council 32 represents 75,000 active and retired workers in our region, and a very large percentage of them drive trucks every day. Nothing is more important to us than the safety of our members, the safety of truck drivers and those who share the roads with them. That is why we have consistently opposed special truck weight carve-outs like this one. We know that heavier trucks on Minnesota roads pose a safety threat to those driving them and to all of us who share the roads with them. Heavier trucks are involved in more deadly crashes. They have higher out-of-service rates and brake violations, and they cause more wear and tear on our already stressed road infrastructure. It is worth pointing out that this particular bill would be an especially large exemption from the 80,000-pound standard for trucks in Minnesota, setting a dangerous precedent for trucks fully 50% heavier than most of us are allowed to use. It is also worth pointing out a Minnesota Public Radio story from last November. NPR reported that North Dakota sugar beet growers from the MinDAC cooperative were actively testing autonomous trucks during last fall's harvest. Fortunately, they aren't allowed on this side of the border, but I think it's fair to ask this committee, if you grant this exemption, how long do you think it will be before this industry is asking you to allow 122,000-pound autonomous trucks to drive through our cities? Finally, do we really think that if we allow these huge North Dakota sugar beet trucks on our roads that this committee won't be hearing requests from Minnesota sugar beet farmers to haul their beets with 122,000-pound trucks? Of course we will. This bill will set up, in our opinion, a dangerous precedent and lead to larger trucks on our roads every day. Thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there any questions or comments on this testimony? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? Okay, seeing none. Any last thoughts, Representative Keel?
Yes, I would like to kind of address some of the concerns. First of all, when we look at the truck weights, I would tell you that when I was young, I would never have thought I would be driving a semi. And my husband actually made me one day. He said, you get in this and drive it because it's not that tough. And but the reason we've needed to do some of the changes we've done is because it's hard to employ someone to come work for you for 2 weeks, maybe 2 months, as Roger said. At harvest can be a long time. And God willing, it normally is about 10 days to 2 weeks. But it's really hard to employ people. They come from all over the United States sometimes to work, whether it's the factory or one of our trucks, to help us to lift this product out. The important part is we're in northern Minnesota, and remember, the weather turns really quickly, and our opportunity to take out our crop is fast depleting because of the weather. And so we're thinking root crops like potatoes aren't asking, but potatoes or carrots are the other thing that Minnesota has problems getting out. But the important part of using this weight truck is our neighbors to our west, I believe even Iowa, allows for heavier truck weights. Yes, it is problematic on the roads if you keep driving them all year long. I would say there's maybe an argument there. But this is a short time, and more importantly, our trucks have the axles to carry that weight distribution, so that the trucks are able to haul that. As was said, it really lowers the amount of trucks. It's not unreasonable to think that 4,000, it helps to cut down those transportation. It brings the crop into the factory. And trying to think if there was anything else that he had mentioned. And it is a request for a short time. You won't find it happening year-round. We don't look to, and that is the one importance, is that this is a root crop that has to get out of the ground. It cannot be kept. A sugar beet in California can grow for 2 years, but we can't. So Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just want to point out this is not precedent-setting. This has been done before. As a matter of fact, just north of East Grand Forks community, Hallock, Minnesota, they have a canola processing plant there that has a special exemption for weights because most of the canola comes from Manitoba. So it's not precedent setting. Also, this would not go into effect until the harvest of next year. So.
Thank you for that. Chair Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the concern I'm thinking about here is we're talking about trucks coming from North Dakota, and I'm assuming they have to go across the river. And I think in the past what we've heard about truck weights in the wintertime that they can raise because they're frozen roads that they can handle the heavier weights. But even with the additional axles, if I remember from a testimony I've heard in the past, that all that weight's on the bridge. And I guess the question I would have is the bridges that they're talking about going over, would they have the ability and whether this would cause damage to those bridges? And so that's just a concern that I don't need an answer today, but it's just a concern I'm raising because that's, again, what I've heard in the past when we've discussed these on transportation is the roads is not so much, but when you raise the weights, the bridges may not have the capacity, and then we're looking for down the road having to repair, replace bridges. And so that's just a concern I'm raising.
Thank you. We'll hear from Representative Kraft, Representative Murphy, and we have also Representative Elkins now on the list. Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keel, question, how did you determine a permit fee of $300?
Pardon?
There's a permit fee, I think, that changed from to $300. Like, how did you come up with that fee for this?
That was requested by the DOT. And every transportation sugar beet hauler gets a permit from the DOT that we have to pay yearly.
Representative Kraft.
Mr. Representative Keel, so is this fee different than what, because I thought I read somewhere that it was going from $60 to $300. Is this fee different than if you were driving a 80,000 pound truck?
That would be the case. we now do pay $60, and I don't even think DOT could confirm, but I don't think it really covers much of the cost other than the paperwork. It's a request so that our law enforcement, when they would pull us over to see if we were in the weight that we were supposed to be in, we have a paper in our truck that says, yes, in fact, we have paid the permit, and yes, in fact, we have abided by the rules, and we get weighed every once in a while on the side of the road, which is another debate all in itself. To acknowledge the fact that we're requesting that service for 2 months.
Real.
Oh, sure. Yes. Representative Kraft.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so you may not have this answer, but I am curious as to, there is added wear and tear on the roads, if that goes into the factoring in the cost at all of the permit. No. Okay.
No, that would be our property taxes that we have to pay.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Mr. Moe.
There are two different truck operations. There's one that's the grower, trucks from the field to the piling station. And then they truck them, and that's what we're requesting here, is from the piling stations to the plants. And those are bigger trucks than the farmers have, and this is a request for, like I said, about 2.5 miles across a very, very big bridge, by the way, in East Grand Forks and Grand Forks,
refurbished.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Excuse me.
But there are two different truck hauls, so I just want to point that out. Different size trucks.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. Representative Murphy, then Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a long history of driving large trucks. And I can just say this is going to help safety. This is going to mean less traffic, less travel. There's very little opportunity for damage to roads when you continue to add axles. So axles is where you change the ton, the weight per axle, and that's what the road feels.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's very much opportunity for the road to suffer much at all when we increase the weight. The workforce is a huge issue in rural Minnesota, and there's just no opportunity to get this process done if we can't utilize these higher weights. It's really difficult for the beef processors. You know, these trucks are safe. They're built for this. Their brakes, their tires, everything's built for it. Typically, they all go by gross vehicle weight when you license them, but the trucks are built for this kind of weight. So that's not a problem. I think this is just really good common sense. This is a short distance. I was listening. I had some guys come in. They talked about increasing our roads, and they said if we added 1 inch of concrete and took away 1 inch of Class 5, we would increase the life of a road by twice. Well, maybe that's what we need to look at some of these roads. But in this case, well, adding those extra axles for a couple miles is not even a consideration. So thank you.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just realized that upon rereading the DE that the axle weight limitations would still apply. So that was my question. Okay.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Any further discussion? Members, good discussion we've had. Any last thoughts, Representative Kiel?
Real quick. Thank you very much. I always appreciate being able to talk about the industry that upholds the Red River Valley and offers opportunity for a lot of people and a lot of different walks of life. And so it's what is the heartbeat of the valley, and I'm proud to say I'm part of it. But thank you very much for hearing this bill.
Thank you. So with that, I'll renew the motion that House File 3374 as amended be laid over, and House File 3374 as amended is laid over.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Our fourth bill today is House File 4350, Lead Petersburg.
The vector is up to the table.
Lead Petersburg, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move 4350, and I also have an amendment A1, which is kind of cleaning up some of the discussions and stuff we've had with in the Senate as well, and to try to nothing of those of that amendment is major, but it does clarify a few other things. So I'd like to move that as well.
Okay, and that amendment is
A1,
coded A1. Is there discussion of the A1? Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the bill is now amended as the author intends us to consider it. Lead Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For a lot of us, I think this may be the most fun thing we're going to talk with and deal with today because if I had the Jetsons soundtrack, I'd play that as well because we are talking about flying cars. But in reality, just to kind of clarify it, this is actually about an aircraft that can drive on the roads, okay? So a lot of people were concerned that, hey, we're talking about changing a lot of things aerodynamically and all that stuff. No, we're not dealing with the airplane side of it at all. This is simply about something. And I would like to, if I can get this going here, I have a video as well. You do have something in your packet? But just something to try to get it here. Let's see. Where's my mouse? Oh, there it is.
Travel has become extremely stressful, with delays being the norm rather than the exception. But what if we could create a new way to travel? something that could make it fun again. And give us the freedom to travel on our own terms. Something that could drive or fly, so we are never stopped. Maybe something like this.
So again, it gives you kind of a feel for the opportunity for those that have additional money. It's something that's not cheap, but can you imagine going into your garage, getting in a vehicle, drive to the airport because you still have to land and take off on a runway, take off and go 200-400 miles away, fold it back up, drive around whatever event that you wanted to go to, and then fly back home and park it back in your garage. That's quite a change from what we're thinking currently. And so this legislation is saying, and I'd like to read one of the people that is the legal analyst for Samson Sky, which is what you just saw, says about this. Rotable aircraft, what is it? Because it has two distinct modes of transportation, rotable aircraft are subject in two classifications, and with those comes double the compliance requirements, double the fees, double the paperwork, etc. Knowing that multi-classification vehicles are around the corner, he started researching, you know, what was needed, and came up with this bill. In addition, as he goes on to say, in addition to the legislation, they are held to the FAA requirements because it is an airplane, and so inspection modes and all that stuff are there. But if these vehicles, and as he said in other discussions I had with him, there are multiple companies out there that are looking at providing and are going through the inspections and the testing and everything that the FAA requires, as they become more and more available, if they're going to be on our roads, we need to figure out how are we going to register them, license them, insure them? How are we going to make sure that they're safe on the road as well? And so this bill actually just starts that process to the point where we can figure out when a police officer needs to stop somebody or if they're in a car accident or whatever, heaven forbid, that they would have the information available them for them to know what's going on. Now, just to be clear, you still have to have a pilot's license. You still have to do all inspection fees for the airplane itself. Kind of nice thing about this particular aircraft that can drive on roads is that it uses regular premium fuel. It doesn't require airplane fuel, so there's no lead in it as well. So that's a positive. And it has about 11,000 foot ceiling, and I think they could, in the air, depending on circumstances, in excess of 150 miles an hour to 200 miles an hour, anywhere from 200-400 mile range. So it has some flexibility. But what we're talking about here in this committee is about what we do when they're on the roads. There is one thing that we're continually looking at is whether or not this should be classified as a motorcycle or an auto cycle. We still need to refer to that. We're unsure about what other companies might be using for instrumentation and so forth, but otherwise this is really something for us to do. This company hopes to have the first off the assembly line in 2025, so it's coming close. They claim that they have about 2,500 people lined up to purchase these already, and so it's going to be an interesting call. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will leave it up to you for discussions and having a time to talk about it. Well, by the way, there's in your handbook, there's more with some pictures, too, in your packet there. So.
Thank you, Lead Petersburg. Representative Kraft is first on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Petersburg. So I just want to understand some things. What does doing this, like, why do we need to do this now? If we didn't do what you're suggesting, why now when there's, so why do we need to do this?
I have two reasons for doing it now. One is it's going to take a while for other states to get involved with it, too, and this allows us to kind of be the lead on determining how to do that. And it also allows everybody to have a little bit more time to vet it, because if the first one rolls off the assembly line in 25, it could be here in Minnesota. And then we hope that we would have that information on how to register it there, because otherwise it would have to sit on the field and the airports until it can be, because it's going to be driving on the roads. And so this gives us an opportunity. I mean, we're at 24 already. So as you know, most things take a little bit of time to get in place. So it's an opportunity for us just to stay ahead of it. But if we don't do it, you're absolutely right. Nothing's going to fall apart or anything, but we'll have to then deal with it next year.
Representative Crown.
Mr. So does this make it easier for these to be on our roads?
Yes.
Okay. So I will say I appreciate that this looks cool. Okay. But I think you also said these use automobile fuel as a plus. I mean, I have all kinds of questions about this cool looking technology around climate change impacts of it. Also, this is not land use impacts of this, right? This is not about, as you indicated, this is not something for all but the wealthiest among us. It can also facilitate people living further and further away, exacerbating sprawl issues. If these are based on automobile fuel, are they subject to fuel economy standards? So it said, looks cool, but I think there's a whole host of questions before we get to a point of saying we should make it easier for these to be on our roads. So I appreciate you kind of laying this out there, but I have some, you know, just concerns about this new class of thing and the impacts that it will have. So thank you.
And Mr. Chair, if I could just clarify a little bit, remembering that everything takes a little bit of time to move forward, and I think your questions and your concerns are valid. Remembering that right now almost all aircraft require aircraft fuel, which is leaded for airplanes of this type. This is going to reduce that. It's not a vehicle that you're going to be driving on a regular basis from home. It's really an opportunity for you to be able to drive to the airport, fly to another location, and maybe drive around there a little bit, but it's not going to be used as a main source of transportation, which has some limiting factor on regards to that. But in either case, whether or not all the things that you talk about are important, they are still going to be sold, and they still are going to be here and available, and people are going to want to be able to drive them home to their houses. So how do we deal with that in the meantime? If we want to talk about other requirements for them, I think that's valid in order to do that. But this bill really deals with the licensing and registration on the ground. It doesn't deal with the environmental impacts that per se.
Representative Kraft.
Yeah, Mr. Lee Pierce. So I appreciate that. I'm just pointing out that we're taking a step here, that there's a broader discussion, and sure. So I'm interested in that broader discussion, as opposed to a step that might lead us down a path that precludes some of that broader discussion.
Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, for people with kids, are they going to make a minivan version of this?
You know, I'm sure that will be up to development. As with all technology and growth, it is. Right now, it's considered a two-seater with luggage with that. But just as we start with many things, it's going to be impactful on that. Because I'm sure it's not like you could put them on a top carrier or something, right?
might mess with aerodynamics.
Yes, exactly. But it is interesting. And you know, the cost figure is a little bit hefty at $150,000 to $200,000. But when you consider the fact that four-wheel drive pickup that a lot of people are getting and other cars, they're pushing $100,000 already. And then on top of that, you now have an airplane also. So it is going to be limited. You know, it's not going to be for everybody. It's not going to have a lot of numbers. But what do we do with them once they're on the road here in the state? So.
Representative West. Oh, did you have a follow-up?
I just wanted to say that $200,000 sounds like a cheap airplane.
It is.
Representative West.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can say I, for one, will not stand in between my constituents and the future of flying cars. I mean, how long have people been waiting for this? This has been a beautiful concept. Just a couple things. As Representative Peterberg said, it's not going to be widely adopted, so climate impacts I don't think are hugely to be concerned with. And we want our policy to be encouraging innovation, not forcing innovation to wait for our laws to catch up with it. And also, saying it's for the wealthiest among us, well, horses were for the wealthiest among us back in the day. The Model T was for the wealthiest among us back in the day. And those technologies became widely adopted by the broader public, but it did start being very expensive. So I don't think we should stand in the way of innovation. I think this is how we do get to the future of flying cars, which sounds awesome to me. And this is what our constituents have been dreaming of for many, many years. So thank you for bringing this bill, Representative Petersburg. This is definitely probably the coolest bill we're going to have in this committee.
Okay, Representative Brand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions I have. Will operators of this vehicle have to be required to produce a flight plan, takeoff and landing?
And Mr. Chair, I don't know that, but they have to follow whatever a normal airplane would require. This has about 11,000-12,000 foot ceiling in which it can fly. That's different compared to what other airplanes do, but if a regular airplane were to require a flight plan for that area, this would as well. It doesn't change any of the requirements of an airplane at all. And so I can't give you that answer completely at this time, but I can find out for you. My guess is almost everybody has to fill a flight plan, so I'm guessing yes, that they do. I think that could be done online now. So.
Okay. Then I, Mr. Chair. Another question I have, thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question I have is power lines, cities, that sort of thing. I mean, we're talking about maybe landing in condensed areas where there's lots of traffic versus all in the country, there are power lines that sometimes overhang the road. Are we going to have to do something to mark our power lines better so that way these planes can land in the open spaces out in the middle of in the country? Are we going to try to restrict it from landing down in Main Street, in St. Peter, places like that? I mean, what can we say about that?
Okay, so that, thank you for that clarification, because we need to clarify this. This does not change where they have to take off from. It has to be from a licensed airport. You can't land on the road. And specifically in the bill, that's against law to do that. You just can't, unless it's emergency situations, which airplanes can as well. So they have to. You have to drive to a local, which can be a very small airport close by to all of us, land and take off, because I think this one here requires about 1,100 feet in order to take off. So it's something that can't be done on the roads. So just understand that when it's on the roads, it's going to be have to be compacted back into roadable design. So you don't have to worry about lines or any of that stuff because they can't take off from there.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One observation I would make is that at this scale of vehicle, you could easily see electric versions. You know, electric airplanes for short-haul travel is already a thing. So they don't necessarily have to be powered by gasoline. And I think this is a fascinating discussion to be having. And I think, I don't know, Representative Petersburg, is this the first bill in the country as far as you're aware?
No, out on the East Coast. Let's see. The information is here. There's another state that already has passed this, and it's out on the East Coast. And where's my information? New Hampshire has already passed this bill as well, and it's getting started.
Yeah, so Mr. Chair, this is the kind of discussion that would be fascinating to have at the NCSL level. So I'm very happy that Representative Petersburg has brought this forward to begin the discussion.
Okay. Last on our list is Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Petersburg, for bringing this bill. This has been great conversation. Mm-hmm. I think we haven't talked really about the efficiency of business travel. So I purchased a Cessna 140 with four other people and learned how to fly. And it was something we all wanted to learn how to fly. It was great. And so we all learned how to fly. And with business travel, though, this completely changes the game plan. If you have a pilot or two in your business and you want to be efficient at doing business, you can. And business travel versus hopping in a jet, I like my chances at climate change with this one. You know, as far as being expensive, I think you weigh all that out, especially from a business standpoint, especially the ability to spread it over a number of different people. This is a great option. With regard to flight plans and being a pilot, you know, pilots are required to do those things. And so if they're required to be a pilot, they're required to do those things. That's just the way I look at that. And I'm really anxious to have that climate change discussion. I think that'd be great. I think we really need to look at the core of it. I think we need to make sure we ask why. We always get the feeling that we all know this is true. But I think that's important to do. So I appreciate Mr. Representative Kraft for bringing that up. That's all I have, but thank you. Great bill. Appreciate it.
Okay, any other discussion? Lee Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know that we're moving this to lay it over. But I want to say that, again, as we talk about this, this is one of the first exciting actually changes in transportation modes that we've had in years. Otherwise, we've just kind of playing around with the existing travel and so forth. And as it's in its infancy, there is so much more potential as you start looking at it. I mean, we're talking about now automated cars. It could very well be into the future in which this particular piece of equipment could be automated. And what more easy to automate into the air than it is on the ground even. And so, and energy-wise, hydrogen power, it could also be electric power. All those things are going to be developed as we move forward. So this is now in the infancy of what could be the largest change in transportation infrastructure for a long time and moving around. So this is just an opportunity, though, for us to make sure that once they are here and they're driving around in our streets, that we make sure that we have all of our I's dotted and T's crossed in regards to registration and so on. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Lee Petersburg. I'll just go on record as a skeptic. appreciate your bringing this forward and discussing it, and of course respect you and your interests. But you know, we have a lot of technology already available to us in the transportation realm and particularly the climate realm, you know, obviously, you know, the future is happening, but yet the automated flying vehicles was a little bit frightening. you know, we haven't really made a ton of progress. I was always a bit skeptical also of the automated vehicle revolution. You know, I think 10 years ago, everyone thought we'd all be driving automated vehicles. So I hope we're driving the most energy efficient, clean vehicles we possibly can, that we're adopting alternatives to giving people options to not drive cars at all. And I thought Representative Kraft made a very good point about land use. And so those are, I think, three areas in which we can focus. But I really appreciate, again, your
interest in this, and you know, we'll continue to monitor it as it potentially moves forward. And it sounds like there's just one company at this point. I haven't heard from GM or others, but we'll see. And I'm glad the committee had some good questions for you. And do you have any final comments? We'll lay over House File 4350.
If I could just say, we know that the information here is all talks about another company in Europe that uses a helicopter style program, that they're not quite as far in the testing. And according to this guy, Mr. Busfield, there are at least four other companies in the United States that are in the process of getting inspections and testing done. So they are going to be around in probably limited ones. And all of your comments are valid. We do have to worry about that. Land use, it doesn't really change anything because it's going from your garage to your garage again. So whatever you can do with that, you can always change land use as well. So that's my thought, and thank you for laying it over.
Yeah, and thanks again. And I think this does also raise questions about aviation and our understaffed air traffic control system, many issues that I think are before us. But again, appreciate you requested a hearing, and we appreciate your bringing this forward. And with that, this bill is laid over, House File 4350. Members, we will be commencing with our regular schedule Tuesday and Thursday of next week, and a number of bills coming in. If you have not requested a hearing date and time, please do that as we are winding towards the bill deadline. So with that, we are adjourned.